From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly update of news and events from around the Latin America Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. So, Tony, a lot of news. Let's jump right in.
Yeah, bewildering set of events happening. There's so many things going on in so many different levels and as it were, on so many different fronts.
Yep.
And the continuing situation in Venezuela is obviously one of the most important things going on in the region, because it's so crucial for future developments in the region overall.
Yeah, I mean,
in South America and the Caribbean.
If this were an electoral map of the direction of the planet, Venezuela would be a swing state at this moment.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And the thing is that, in many ways, it bears out something that we've been talking about over the last several months, and perhaps even longer.
Yeah.
Namely, that this ridiculous idea of a conservative restoration is completely misleading, which isn't to say that the right wing haven't made progress in trying to roll back the gains of progressive governments between, say, in 2000, especially between 2006 and 2013. But the nitty gritty is that for them, the situation in Venezuela is, you know, it's their last chance to kind of wrap up, as somebody put it, Latin America, so that they can devote all their attention to attacking one on economic, diplomatic, media, and even military fronts the developments happening in Eurasia, driven right. by the de facto alliance between the Russian Federation and the People's Republic of China. So Venezuela is really important from a geopolitical point of view, and maybe we can talk a bit more about that if we have time to talk about the recent BRICS summit over the weekend. But there's so many other things going on in the region and that are really important. And so many of them have to do with that geopolitical aspect of Latin America turning away from its dependence, its historic and traditional, conventional, from the point of view of the Latin American and Caribbean elites, dependence on the United States and to some extent Europe. They're turning away from that towards Asia, towards China, towards Southeast Asia, the Southeast Asian countries. And you can see that even in a small country like Nicaragua. And Nicaragua is really developing its relations with Taiwan and South Korea.
Yeah.
And it seems to be playing, not in a cynical way, but in a way, in clear defense of Nicaragua's national interests. It's trying to play off Taiwan, its historic relationship with Taiwan, to which it's been extremely loyal over the last 20 years under whoever's been in power in Nicaragua. And they're trying to play their relationship with Taiwan against the tremendous pressure that they must be coming under from the People's Republic of China to dump Taiwan. And I think that's quite interesting. But
that's
a kind of historical footnote in a way. But the crucial thing is that Nicaragua and the rest of the region are paying a lot of attention to China and Southeast Asia. And you can see that in the way that Mexico was an active participant as an observer country in the recent BRICS summit. And Peña Nieto, the otherwise waste of space president in Mexico, and a completely corrupt guy, totally in hot to the Mexican elites, he's actually doing what he can to defend Mexico's national interest against the grotesque, boorish, brutish pressure that President Trump has been putting on Mexico. For example, in the renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement and and that ridiculous, his ridiculous kind of fetish about a wall, you know, dividing Mexico off from the United States. And Peña Nieto's answer to that is, and the Mexican, and you know, by extension, the Mexican elite's response to that is, well, let's go and talk to China.
China's getting more assertive too. Just read their reports today, for example, with people, you know, this was on Chinese television at CGTN, for example, discussing the utility, if not necessity, of installing Chinese and Russian military personnel on the ground in DPRK in North Korea because of the deterrent effect that that would have. But I mean, in other words, they're saying, let's put our soldiers in the way of the United States to help the North Koreans feel more secure that the United States. I mean, that's fairly assertive for China to do that, as they have been traditionally conducting foreign policy in the period after Mao. And so, you know, it's interesting to see that this is, you know, kind of happening across the board, this, you know, maturation almost of their presence as a player on the world stage.
Yeah, and one has to remember, of course, that China has explicitly said via an article in the Global Times, the kind of official English language news outlet in China, they've told the United States, if North Korea attacks you, we'll be neutral. Right. But if you attack North Korea, we'll fight.
We're coming for you. Right? Yep.
So you know, and that's you can't put it clearer than that, can
you? That's right.
Anyway, going back to Latin America and the way it's developing its relationship, very interesting developments between Peru and Bolivia. Very, very interesting developments there, because over the last week, Evo Morales and President Kuczynski, the Peruvian right-wing president, you know, totally ideologically opposed political programs and governments, they signed agreements about two very important things. One is extending Bolivian use of the port at a place called Ilo on Peru's coast, obviously the Pacific coast, which it gives Bolivia a much better outlet to the Pacific, and kind of finesses the attempts by Chile to effectively blockade Bolivia and make it more difficult for Bolivia to expand its trade via access to the sea. So that port agreement is very, very important. Ilo is only about 8 hours drive from La Paz, the capital of Bolivia. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, Kuczynski and Morales also signed an agreement for an interoceanic railway starting in Peru, crossing the Bolivian Altiplano, going down into Paraguay, and then out across into the Atlantic Ocean, presumably at a port on the Brazilian coast.
Right. Wow.
And what is that for? You know, and it's so obviously an attempt to open up the South American trade to traffic and commerce from Southeast Asia and China.
Yeah.
But look at that for a minute. What does that mean in terms of the conflict between the right-wing free market private business agenda driven by countries like Peru and Chile and Argentina, and the current corrupt administration in Brazil, the corrupt administration in Mexico? That's their model. But there, it's been worked out with a Bolivian government totally committed to socialism and developing socialist alternatives. And Alvaro Garcia Linera, Evo Morales' vice president, is one of the leading socialist ideologues and strategists in Latin America and the Caribbean. A very, very important strategic thinker in terms of developing the whole progressive project across Latin America and the Caribbean. So there you have these two completely opposed ideological points of view collaborating to a common end, which is regional integration. And this goes back to another thing that we've been talking about for years now. What is going to be the model of regional integration? Nobody doubts in Latin America and the Caribbean, whether from a right-wing point of view or a progressive left-wing point of view, that regional integration has to be driven forward if Latin America is going to be able to defend its position in the global international economy and not be completely dependent and subject to the whims and decisions of the great powers like China, the United States, and Europe, and so on. Right. So that recent meeting over the last week, and the decisions taken by the Peruvian and Bolivian governments is really important in terms of the region's future development and possible political implications. So then, all kinds of other stuff's going on. Sticking with that theme of regional integration, something very important also happened last week. I think last weekend, not this weekend, just gone, the weekend before, with an agreement signed by the presidents of Honduras, El Salvador, and Nicaragua about the Gulf of Fonseca. Now, the Gulf of Fonseca is a key strategic bay, a great big bay, on the Pacific coast of Central America, on which El Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua have a common border, and for decades it's been a kind of source of conflict, kind of trivial fishing incidents, for example, and right. Difficulties to do with controlling contraband and all that stuff. And now, what those three governments have done is they've made it what is in not just in Central American terms, but for the whole of Latin America. It's a model agreement of cooperation across frontiers to develop a common space for the economic benefit of the local population and for the region. And that, you know, that's really important if you think about what's going on between Bolivia and Chile, for example. And it makes the Chilean government look like Neanderthal in terms of the positions it's taking vis-a-vis its relations with Bolivia, and you can apply that to almost any frontier conflict throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. The Gulf of Fonseca agreement is a real model that has the backing of very important international financial institutions, and that's also part of, you know, the projection towards Asia, and the it's difficult to overstate how important it is, in particular within the Central American region.
Right.
And then looking at that another aspect of the integration process in Latin America and the Caribbean, also to do principally in this case with Central America and the Caribbean, Cuba has just joined the Central American Bank for Economic Integration. It's BCIE in its Spanish acronym. Mm. Now, the BCIE isn't a big development bank, but it's a very important bank in terms of developing regional infrastructure. And the fact that Cuba has joined it is a clear indication that the region is going ahead regardless of what the United States may think about Cuba. It's much more important for the region and for its economic structures and the expressions of its economic needs and its the direction of its economic strategy. It's much more important to integrate Cuba than to be forever looking over their shoulder at what people think in Washington. You know.
Agreed.
So and all these things are going on, Don.
Yeah.
That point to why the United States is so desperate to destroy Venezuela, because the region is going ahead, and it doesn't matter if you're looking at it from a right-wing point of view or from a left-wing point of view, the region is going to go ahead and integrate. It's going to go ahead and develop its relations with China and Southeast Asia, and the United States is simply going to get left behind. And that's what's going to happen.
And that's been happening, actually. That's the trend that we've observed and discussed over the past years, really. Even right-wing governments that have come to power have felt compelled, have been compelled to work forward on these projects with Venezuela and others because they bring bacon home to their people that those people expect. So,
and of course that doesn't mean that the right wing and this, in particular the elements of the regional right wing allied with the United States and loyal to interests in, say, Wall Street or Silicon Valley or wherever they may have their loyalties. I mean, it doesn't mean that they're giving up on their own agenda, on their own greedy, selfish elite agenda. And you can see that, of course, in what's happening in Venezuela. But that, even that, is mitigated by what's happening in places like Colombia, for example. We should point out that Pope Francis is going to be making a very important visit to Colombia, I think, tomorrow. He should be arriving tomorrow or the day after.
Yeah, Wednesday or Thursday,
for a six-day visit.
Yeah.
He'll be visiting almost all of Colombia's main cities, Medellin, Bogota, and a couple of other places. And prior to his visit, a very important development for the stability of Colombia. A ceasefire with the other main guerrilla group in Colombia, the Ejército de Liberación Nacional, the ELN. The Santos, Juan Manuel Santos, has negotiated a ceasefire that's, I think it comes into effect almost immediately, and it lasts until the second week in January, provisionally. And so you've got that ceasefire happening. You've got the Pope coming to kind of consolidate. And he's going to make it very difficult for people like Alvaro Uribe, who have fiercely resisted the peace process in Colombia. But the visit by the Pope is just going to knock that out. It's just going to completely flatten Alvaro Uribe's position against the ceasefire. Because I mean, what's he going to do? Criticize Pope Francis?
Right. Not in Colombia.
Forget it. So then, and of course, the other important development over the last week in Colombia has been the official announcement of the new political party by the former guerrilla, the FARC EP guerrilla. They retain the name, the initials FARC, but I think they're calling themselves the Alternative Revolutionary Forces of Colombia now.
Ah.
So that's their political party, and an interesting data that people might want to know is that there was recently a poll about, you know, what is the public feeling about political parties and about the FARC, the new FARC political party, and it turned out that the FARC is actually has a slightly better approval rating, which isn't saying very much, than the mainstream political parties in Colombia, because disapproval for Colombian political parties is running at about 87%. And that's disapproval like for the FARC is running at 85%. So they're 2% ahead of the traditional political parties.
That's like the competition here in the United States between the press and Congress. You know, that's those kind of numbers. That's what they have here.
Right. So then other stuff going on in the region that's also very important. And down in Argentina, there was a huge protest about something that we mentioned in I think a couple of weeks ago, which is very, very important in the Argentinian context, which is the disappearance of an indigenous peoples activist called Santiago Maldonado. He's an activist for the struggle of the Mapuche people in Argentina, and he was disappeared during a police operation, a security forces operation, to close down a Mapuche protest. I don't know the exact area, but it's well outside Buenos Aires. And he's disappeared. Now, in Argentina, Argentina is a country that during the 80s right. suffered something like 30,000 disappearances of progressive people opposed to the military dictatorship at the time. So for Mauricio Macri to be in power, and to because the Macri family was very associated with the military dictatorship, along with the rest of the Argentinian right wing, for Santiago Maldonado to be disappeared now under the Mauricio Macri regime is a very, very serious and symbolic thing to have happened.
Yep.
And the response of Macri's functionaries has been odiously reminiscent of the way the dictatorship government back in the 1980s reacted to the claims of disappearances, the mass disappearances for which they were responsible. You know, the dismissive, contemptuous,
right.
really outrageous, absolutely outrageous, and that has happened at the same time as a kind of a relatively moderate kind of political gerrymandering and electoral gerrymandering by the right-wing authorities in the Buenos Aires, the recent elections, the primary elections in Buenos Aires prior to the legislative elections that I think are happening. When are they happening? End of October, early November, something like that.
Yeah.
And Cristina Fernandez has turned out to be the winner by a very narrow margin, but she's still the winner, which is a triumph for her, given everything. Because in Argentina, in the same way that the right wing have thrown everything that they've got trying to overthrow the presidency of Nicolas Maduro, in Argentina, even though Cristina was in opposition, the right wing, the right wing media, the government, the judiciary that's controlled by the right wing, they've done everything they can to rubbish Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. And despite that, she won that election in Buenos Aires, where the right wing have a very strong base.
Yeah, that's their base, yeah. Yep.
So,
that's a good sign, I think, for things coming forward, and a bad sign for Macri and his people.
Well, maybe not so bad, because they didn't do badly in those elections. But that, I know, as you and I have commented in our recent conversations, one of the fundamental problems for the progressive movements in Latin America is unity, and what you've got in Argentina is a divided Peronism, which is the kind of traditional progressive party in Argentina. You've got that's divided, and that divides the opposition vote, and opens clears the way for the right wing to get into power and to stay in power.
Mm.
But the legislative elections will be very important later on this year. And that human rights element is also very present in Mexico, because I think in part because of the protest from Venezuela about the incredibly biased way the United Nations system has been gamed to criticize the developments in Venezuela. In part in response to that, the UN recently came out with a report heavily critical of the Mexican government, in particular in relation to the disappearance and apparent murder of 43, and when you say it, it just sounds outrageous.
I know.
43
students,
trainee teachers, were killed in Mexico, and yet people focus on an alleged abuse of human rights in Venezuela.
Right.
No, nothing like that happens. Ever happens in Venezuela.
And in Mexico, it's so frequent. Yeah, in Mexico. In Mexico, it's so frequent that when they were digging around looking in mass graves, they kept finding, oh, not this mass grave. Oh, not that mass grave. Oh, not.
That's right.
Like, there were mass graves everywhere, but they couldn't find the students in any of them.
And the horrific figure in Mexico of missing people. There are 36,000 missing people in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
No,
I guess they need GPS, better GPS or something. I don't know.
Right,
it's ridiculous.
So then, it was very interesting to see that the UN finally came out with a report. Criticizing the egregious human rights abuses in Mexico. Mm. So, and other stuff going on, a very important development in Guatemala, completely reminiscent of what happened to the former president, Otto Perez. And the guy that replaced Otto Perez, Jimmy Morales, who falsely claimed that he'd bring an anti-corruption drive into Guatemala's government and public life.
Well, he's a comedian. It was just a joke.
Well, yeah, it was a joke, and of course, the irony there is that he came to public prominence originally as a very popular comedian.
Right.
So then, and he's now in exactly the same position as Otto Perez was, accused by the local judiciary of. Abusing electoral finance, and also his brother and his son are caught up in some kind of fraud that necessarily is going to taint Jimmy Morales because they're his close family, and so what's happened there is that there's an attempt. I think the Supreme Court has agreed to. Begin initial judicial proceedings by way of investigating whether Jimmy Morales should be indicted. And also, the National Assembly is considering whether or not to lift his presidential immunity.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that very familiar kind of saga or telenovela going on in Guatemala. And of course, that bears out what you and I were commenting way back when the Otto Perez affair was coming to a climax and Jimmy Morales was eventually elected. And all that happened was that one corrupt section of the Guatemalan elite exited power, and another corrupt section of the Guatemalan elite entered power. That's all that happened.
Yeah, it's like political mud wrestling.
So, and that's there's that, and then important developments also in Brazil on the corruption front, where a public prosecutor has revealed that some. Do you use the term in the United States supergrass, like somebody who informs in order to get a better deal? No, somebody who's indicted for a crime who then informs the authorities so that he gets a better deal and a shorter prison sentence.
Nah, the word snitch is used, and there are other terms, but not that particular one, no. But I understand the concept.
In Britain and Ireland, the supergrass is the term for somebody with very... important information that can cause problems for a lot of people. And so This public prosecutor in Brazil has revealed that two or three business people caught up in corruption investigations who'd done a deal with the authorities in order to get a lesser prison sentence or lesser penalties.
Right. Please,
they accidentally recorded stuff that they hadn't wanted to record in public. It's like Charlie Chaplin or the Keystone Cops.
The gang that couldn't steal straight. We're going to have to leave it there and pick this up next week.
Well, just quickly, and what that means is that more trouble for Temer and his league.
Good, because we're looking at the presidential elections next year, so that's getting closer. All right, Tony, thank you very much. A pleasure as always, and very enlightening as always as well. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now.
For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.